Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you very much for choosing to come to this session. We know there's a lot of stiff competition, so it looks like we've probably got the real groupies here who really care about group life. And so this is called Lessons from the Courtroom. We're very lucky that we've got two people who care very deeply about how to improve group insurance, particularly for the consumer. And so we will learn, we can benefit from mistakes made by other people, and we can find out about class actions, courtroom actions, about insurance, and what steps to take to avoid them. So I've been told not to say their bios to save time, so we just welcome Jeff Humphreys, Director of CHR Consulting, and Karen Lau, who is an insurance governance leader in the trustee office at Mercer Super.
Thank you, Margaret, and thank you for coming to our session today. We've actually written a paper, which is very exciting. So if there's something in here that does excite you, you can go to the paper. It's reasonably long, but it's very readable because they're broken up into all these nice sections. All the work we've done for this paper is from publicly available information. And we've brought it all together and then tried to work out, well, what are the learnings out of all this information we've got? What are the latent risks? And what role do actuaries play? Particularly important, I think, because there's a bigger role for actuaries. So they're the sections of our paper up there. These are the ones we're looking at in our presentation because we only have that much time, so five of them. Bit of background, what has happened with the litigation and the regulatory intervention. Deep dive into some case studies, what are the learnings, and then what's the role for actuaries to help trustees. Okay, so a bit of background. Just why is insurance important? Let's start 101. So APRA came up with, I thought it was a pretty good definition, affordable and widely held insurance supports a resilient and productive economy by protecting households against large and unexpected losses. So it's fairly clear, but it's a very succinct definition. And then if we go to the next step, why is insurance and super important? Well, what we know from the ABS data that we have is that the ability to earn future income is really the 80% of people, it's their greatest asset. Your future income is your greatest asset. Insurance and super is the primary source of protection of that asset for most people through the default system. And most people have very little actual savings outside super to help them. And while you can get hardship through super, it's there isn't really a lot of, until you get into the top 20% households, you don't get a lot of saving outside super. And we know there's a high risk, and the Institute published this 30% number last year. Yeah. Last year, the Insurance and Super Subcommittee had a look at this. And if you just run the rates, the claim rates, through from age 18 through to age 67, you find 30% of people are going to have an insured event. So it's a high-risk event over your lifetime. And I think of my friends, and that's right, my male friends. It's affordable and broadly accessible through the default fund system. It's a pay now option. It's a receive now, pay later system. It impacts your retirement income. The fact that you have insurance now, it only impacts the future. It doesn't impact now. So you buy now, you pay later. But there are some big cash flows. There's lots of premium going out of super funds. There's lots of claim payments coming back in. And trustees are managing quite a complex system. Multi-party is a problem, and a lot of rules. So the most important rules are the SysAct covenants. And just going through those quickly, act honestly. They're fairly straightforward, aren't they? You'd think we wouldn't have to have these, but we do. Act honestly. Care, due diligence. Members' best financial interest, which we all know and love. manage conflicts, fairness. Fairness is a very important one because that's fairness between class and within a class. That class is the class of license, but it's not a cohort of members. It's a class of license, but within a class, very important covenant. And there's the member outcome. Then the green ones there are the insurance covenants. And basically they say you need to have appropriate insurance. Make sure it doesn't inappropriately erode or what we call reduce retirement income and pursue claims if they've got a chance of being paid. And what happened in July 2021 was the onus of proof. If the regulator comes to the trustee and says you've done the wrong thing, then you've got to prove you haven't. That's enormously different. To have to prove someone has done something wrong, you have to prove you haven't done something wrong. So you need an evidentiary base for that. You need to have kept the evidence. You need to have gone over all the possible scenarios. So it's quite an onerous provision now on the member's best financial interest. And what I think we'll discuss later anyway is that actuaries play a big role in helping trustees meet that evidentiary requirement. So they have to be able to prove it's acted in the member's best financial interest. And if you think about that, that involves thinking about a lot of scenarios, not just one, and then saying, oh, I've done all the research I need to, I've done all the thinking I need to. Okay, the Royal Commission is the reason we're here. Made 76 recommendations. The Royal Commission was into banking and super, so it wasn't just super. 76 recommendations, 76 were accepted by government. What has it ever done for us? So in some ways you might say it's a gift because it's a review of our industry by independent people telling us how we're running. A little bit of a poll now, and we're not going to do that using our phones, we're just going to use things called our hands. Who thinks the Royal Commission made a difference? Just about everybody. Okay. So the next question is, who thinks the Royal Commission still makes a difference now? Not so many. It's a very interesting outcome. So one of the things we have done is pulled a lot of the outcomes of that Royal Commission together. But let's just go over what the Royal Commission actually did say. They said there were four underlying issues in our industry. The connection between conduct and reward, or if you like, the misconnection between those. The asymmetry of power and information between the provider and the consumer. The effect of conflicts between duty and interest, and the regulators weren't holding people to account. So those are the four big underlying issues. I've got a couple of quotes that come out of there just to remind us how serious things were. How the Royal Commissioner saw them. Primary responsibility for misconduct in the financial services industry lies with the entities concerned and those who managed it, their boards and senior management, and we need to do something about that, the governance, remuneration practices, etc. The next one's on conflicts of interest. Too often sought to strike some compromise between the interests of members and their own interests or a related third party. So all these are in the paper. Want to read them? Trustee has a duty to identify relevant considerations before making decisions. Right, it's the duty of care. And I'll just go through to, this is the regulators. All the conduct contravened existing norms of conduct and that the most serious conduct broke existing laws. Notwithstanding that, the law was too often not enforced at all or not enforced effectively. So not a lot of nice stuff to say about the regulators, and said they should be reviewed every 4 years and said it should be immediate for APRA. Okay, so I'm going to hand over to Karen.
Thank you, Jeff. post-Royal Commission landscape. Since 2018, after the Royal Commission, the superannuation funds have become a focus for plenty of firms and regulators, and there we have seen a wave of class actions and the regulatory litigation since then. So 11 class actions and 24 regulator actions. So let's have a quick chat about what class actions are and how do they work. Parties commonly include many parties, applicant, defendants, normally the trustee, the funders, we'll come back to funders a bit later, members who opt in or members who don't opt out from the class action, service providers, lawyers, experts. So you can see there is many, many parties involved when there is a class action. The common funding method for a class action is on the basis of no win, no fee, and plus litigation funding. What are the standard outcomes? Settlements, discontinuance, or a verdict. Settlement is when both parties agree not to go all the way to a verdict, but they agree on the settlement amount usually paid by the defendant, which is a trustee. And although this outcome needs to be court approved. And if there is a settlement that is usually considered a win for the plaintiff, where the trustee will agree to pay an amount. And however, the amount that's eventually paid in a settlement to members is not the settlement paid by the trustee because they have to minus the amount by the deductions. And what are the deductions? The deductions are the litigation costs, the legal fees and stuff, plus the funder commission. Coming back to that funder in red, they invest in a class action. They get a chunk of commission out of that. We'll talk a bit about more about that later on when we go into the deep dive. What are the impact of a class action, especially from the trustee's perspective? A class action can turn what may start as a discrete insurance or administration issue into a prolonged, highly scrutinized governance event for a trustee. The practical impacts can be very significant. These include management distraction, taking them away from their day job, reputational harm, which can often last a long time, and also substantial costs. What are the common themes in a class action? Default cover design, when there is an issue with the default cover design, decisions on insurer tenders or renewals, disclosure or communications to members by the trustees, and oversight and conflict of interest. For regulatory enforcement, the common theme we see is claims handling and complaints, disclosure and communication again, operational integrity and remediation, and conflicted remuneration. If you have a chance to read the paper, I highly recommend it. Have a look at the themes that the class actions and the litigations that fit into each of those themes. The next part, we're going to deep dive into six case studies of class actions and asset litigation. The first one is Q Super Class Action. How many of you have heard of this one? Oh, not all of you. Fantastic. Good. The case started in 2021 and it lasted all the way to until very recently, 2026, before it settled. And the relevant date for that class action is all the way back to 2016, which is 10 years ago. It's a long time ago. What are the allegations? The core allegation. There are many allegations, but I'm just going to talk about the core. Member communications are inadequate or misleading, especially for the introduction of opt-in for white-collar premium rates. So white-collar premium rates is cheaper, so the communication to members is not clear. What do they need to do? What is the trustee defense? The trustee say the opt-in was prudent as the trustee does not have occupational data, which is fair enough, but then they say the communications were sufficient. What is the response to that defense? They say the communications to the members are still omitted the election requirement for a member to elect their white collar. It's not very clear in the communication that members need to act. So that's where we got to. And then we went straight to the outcome. Didn't go all the way to verdict. So there was a proposed settlement amount of $67 million where both parties agreed on with no admission of fault by the trustee, which is very interesting. However, only $36 million of that is available to be distributed to members after deductions, litigation costs, and the funding payment to the funder. And in this case, the $67 million is funded from the General Reserve. So that, in a way, tells you that it's basically funded by members indirectly. And that is subject to court approval, and I believe it's been approved, probably. We haven't seen it.
We haven't seen it.
Yeah. Okay, that's Q super class action. BT or Asgard super class action happened. The class action went for 1 year, which is a very short time. The relevant period goes back to 2016. What is a core allegation? In the 2016 tender, AIA scored higher as an insurer on the weighted criteria, but the trustees selected a related party, which is the Westpac Insurance, via a non-weighted criteria. And as a result, members paid a higher premium. What is the defense from the trustee? The trustees say the tender was properly governed with independent support. So they got an independent reviewer to provide that independent review to support that decision. And importantly, they also look at non-weighted criteria, which include transition risk, financial strength, revenue uplift, and alignment to future state. So what is the outcome of this class action? A very different outcome to the Q Super one. This class action was discontinued after just 1 year. Both parties agreed after a strikeout application by the trustee claiming parts of the pleadings are defective. The court approved this discontinuance in 2024 and no compensation was paid. This is a very interesting result because we don't see many of this. We'll talk a bit more about the learnings from this later on. Colonial First Day class action, very similar to the BT case. 2020-2025, and the class action went on for 5 years, and relevant period went all the way back to 2014 to 2022. The core allegations, similar to the BT case, that the trustee selected a related party insurer, resulted in an excess premium paid by members. What is the defense? The defense is that the trustee denied the breaches. Covenants were applied per statute and supposed to be read with the trustees. And related party dealings were permitted by the deed to the extent lawful, and liability limitations were argued. And what is the outcome of this one? Under this class action, there was a settlement agreed of $140 million, and again, with no admission of fault. It's a very, very large amount. Is it the second largest amount? Second largest amount on settlement on the class action. Very interesting. In 2025. Okay. And 81 million of this is available for distribution to 850,000 group members after deduction. So again, about 40% of that amount is lost. In this case, the funding of that settlement is funded by the Dell's shareholder, CBA, not from members. Okay, pass it over to you, Jeff.
Thanks, Karen.
So a couple more. Next one's the AMP. Commissions and insurance. This one was really about the impact of commissions on the insurance premium. There are a few things going on, but it has an insurance flavour because of the excess commissions flow through into premium rates. There was a settlement of $29 million, no admission of guilt. Again, case that takes 5 years, a relevant period that's basically last decade, not this decade. So very long delay period. Now, we've got a couple of other ones where ASIC has been involved. Australian Super, not to pick out Australian Super in particular, because death benefit delays were wider than just Australian Super, but this is a good example. Australian Super had just come off a penalty from an ASIC case for not doing enough about duplicate accounts, and they'd paid $27 million as a penalty for that. So they're now going for the death benefit delays. The relevant period's 2019 to 2024, and the case is just started and it's ongoing. Core allegations, even though these death claims were no objection claims, so there's only one party you could pay. There's about 7,000 of them with a delay of 4 months to 4 years. And there's a series of allegations. The most serious one perhaps is the fact that even though that these people aren't being paid, they're still being charged fees while the trustee's sitting around making a decision. There's no real defence other than the trustee points out that they've done remediation and they've got operational improvements that are happening. And that one's ongoing. So, you know, watch this space. That will be very interesting. I know other funds have had to pay penalties for delayed death benefits. This one's interesting, even though it's about fees. And in this case, the trustee won. Now, this one's interesting because it actually came before a judge and the judge gave a verdict, which is highly unusual. The other thing they did was the judge put in, effectively into law, case law, a lot of interpretation of the CIS covenants because, yeah, what is a member's best financial interest? What is a conflict? What is fairness? So it's worth noting for that reason. So trustee had a win on this one, but the important point about this case is how much judicial thought went into what do these covenants actually mean. Okay. Star Entertainment. You wouldn't think gambling had much to do with super, although it is an investment strategy, I hear. So ASIC went after the Star directors and their management on duty of care. So this is independent of CIS Act and all that. This is corporations law. But it has some relevance for clearly management and directors of super funds. Case ran from 2022 to 2026, relevant period, 2016-2019. The judge is Judge Lee in this case, went to judgment. Judge Lee is the man who was famously quoted as saying he escaped the lion's den but went back for his hat. Remember that guy? So he's quite an entertaining sort of judge. And he imposed some serious penalties on management. $180,000 one guy has to pay, personal liability for his actions as a manager. The independent directors got away scot-free. But what it shows is ASIC's willing to go after individuals, not just trustee boards or trustees, and they're going to find the money from members or from shareholders. It could end up being a personal liability. So we thought we'd put that one in there. Because that is ASIC, that is the corporations law. Okay, what are some of the learnings from all these cases? So we've, because that's the heading in the in the paper, class actions. So let's compare class actions with regulatory enforcement, because that's very important. Karen's already indicated that class actions aren't terribly efficient from members' point of view. So in a class action, you get a settlement. It's really a commercial risk decision between the trustee on the one hand and the plaintiff lawyers and their funder on the other hand. There's no member's best financial interest consideration on a class action settlement. At some point, typically, neither party wants to go to court because you don't know where the judge will go. Right? So they cut their losses, so to speak. But there's always no admission of fault, even though we've seen some pretty big payouts. There's no admission of fault. I'm not at fault, but here's some money. Right. Regulator action, there is a court outcome, and there will be a penalty. So very, very different, outcomes through the two. The onus of proof in a class action, you've got to prove the trustee's done something wrong. Yeah. The regulator doesn't. The regulator's sitting there saying, you've done something wrong, you prove you haven't. Right. So very different under the new law. Under the old law, that wasn't the case. But under the new law, best financial interest, you have to prove that you haven't done something wrong. In a class action, remediation for members will always be less than 100%. You've had a negotiated settlement. You've had to take a chunk out for the cost of the funding and the experts, the lawyers. So you will never get full remediation because there's no admission of fault. So why do I have to remediate something if I haven't admitted a fault? But the regulator gets remediation and the regulator gets that at 100%. Who funds a class action? Well, typically it's going to be funded through the members, and particularly the members who aren't part of the class action. There was the exception of the Colonial First State, which was funded through the CBA shareholders. Some trustees have trustee liability insurance, and that will pay part of it. But, of course, as soon as you claim, your premium will go up. And, of course, members pay the premium effectively. The regulator actions, indirectly, members are going to fund those. It's just any settlement penalty. Unless, as I say, they go after individuals within the trustee. Prevention is always better than cure. What's best for members? We put together a little hierarchy. So clearly early trustee detection of a error or omission and immediate remediation, that's the best outcome for members. It's also the best outcome for the trustee, as it turns out. And then we go downhill from there. Maybe a later identification and remediation. Third party detects it, maybe through the through an audit or an advisor. Regulator enforcement. If the regulator finds the error, that's a pretty bad place to be. There are breach. Yeah, if you've breached your duties, you've got 10 days to advise the regulator, and then the regulator will come looking. Class actions, we're getting near the bottom. They're not a great outcome for members, but they're better than doing nothing. So that's the hierarchy we thought would be, from members' point of view, for errors and omissions. Every successful class action should have been a regulator action. That's a statement. It's also a question. Is it a good measure of the regulators? So we wouldn't expect many more class actions. If the regulators are active, we wouldn't expect class actions. We expect more regulator, particularly with the power of the proof, the onus of the proof. Okay, so in the paper we've got this table because we've got a lot of parties in the second row across the top there, group members, other members, applicant lawyers, da-da-da-da. We could have added experts. And we've rated one is a good outcome for you, is a bad outcome, five is a good outcome. And we've just rated the different scenarios. So is there a court judgment, yes or no? Is there a discontinuance, a settlement, loss with costs for the defence or a win? And just two interesting things out of this table. Members not involved in the class action, they never win because they're likely that at least the defence costs are going to be met by them. The trustee has to defend itself. And the trustee lawyers always win. and perhaps the experts win too. Perhaps not. More learnings, Karen.
Okay, more learnings. Outsourcing doesn't shift accountability from the trustee to the third party. I know it sounds pretty straightforward and given. As we can see in the Australian Super SA action, there is a lot of issue with administration, but you can see that the SA is still taking the trustee to court, not the administrator. Trustee should independently assure controls and end-to-end performance, even for third-party services. It's very important. Lawful is the starting point, not the finish line. As you can see, we work in this industry. We often go to the lawyers and say, can we do this? Can we? Can we is the question that we always ask. But the real question is, should we? Again, it sounds very obvious, but we don't always see that that's the case. Q-Super, for example, the premium difference is permissible, that is correct. And then when it's tested against member first outcome under the unclear communication on the occupation election, it becomes an issue. That's when the litigation risk comes in. The communication is lawful, nothing wrong with it, but is it a member's first outcome should be the question. Market practice and the regulator tick does not mean you are immune. So if you have engaged the regulator on a constant basis on your practices, decisions, or if you are compliant with the SPS 250, no regulatory invention to date, it doesn't mean there is no risk. The standard market practice does not mean it's in members' best financial interest. As we can see, we've discussed TPD earlier today, standard market practice to offer TPD products and still offering, knowing that there is a sustainability issue. It's done by everyone, but it doesn't mean members' best financial interest is met. QSuper and CFS class action shows that. Care, skill, and diligence is a good defense. BT Asgard class action, as I discussed earlier, it only lasted for a year and then it was discontinued. It was a big win for the trustee. And why is that? Because they had proper due diligence in place with independent review and they were able to evidence that at the class action. So they were able to strike out to do a strikeout application that resulted in discontinuance of their class action. And as per the STAR asset action, the personal accountability can attach to governance failures. We have seen many class actions where they sue the super fund as a whole, but we have seen under the STAR action that they went after individuals and the individuals were liable for those liabilities. So that's something the trustee need to look out for. Justice Lee said, is it Justice Lee again? Yeah, okay, same Justice Lee. A director, whether executive or non-executive, is required to take reasonable steps, is expected to take a diligent and intelligent interest in the information available to them, understand that information, and apply an inquiring mind to their responsibilities. What are the other learnings? Legal hierarchy matters. We spoke about earlier with a number of class actions when they talk about refer to the trustees. But what really matters is we need to refer to the CIS Acts, the legislation triumph, the regulations and the trustee agreements and the deeds and the policies and APRA prudential guides and circulars and guidance notes. So ultimately, the question to ask is, are we compliant with the law? Are we compliant with the deed or the IMF? The law supersedes the deed or the IMF. IMF is insurance management framework. The deeds and the insurance management frameworks are just enabling tools. IMF compliance does not necessarily mean legal compliance, especially if the IMF itself is flawed. These proceedings shift the focus from what trustees did to whether what they did was reasonable, defensible, and member-focused in substance. The most consistent learning is that trustees are expected to evidence three things: outcome-based reasoning, active oversight, and timely remediation. Okay. Those are the learnings that we drew from the deep-dived class actions that we did. Now we're going to talk a little bit about latent risk. We're not going to take you through all it, but just give you a bit of flavor of what the latent risks are. What is a latent risk? Latent risks are under the radar areas that are plausible candidates for litigation or enforcement, particularly where the trustee has treated them as operational irritants or pricing realities. But litigants and regulators assess them through the lens of members' first trustee obligations. It's an issue when the litigants or the regulators see that it's not just an operational issue, a one-off, it's a governance failure. A latent risk may emerge as litigation or enforcement if there is member financial detriment at scale. The issue is discoverable through data, trusted minutes, complaints, audits. So basically it's saying that the trustee already know there is an issue and not doing anything about it. And the governance record does not withstand scrutiny. So even if there's no litigation today, it doesn't mean there is no litigation tomorrow. As we can see from many class actions earlier, some of the class actions came in for the period over 5 years ago. So that's like the CFS, for example, and many other ones. Now, we have set out 18 latent risks in the paper. I highly recommend you guys to use it as a checklist for proactive testing if you work in the super fund especially. We don't have time to go through them today. Okay. Now, hopefully this will be an interesting part for reducing trustee risk. How can actuaries help? We spoke about owners of proof earlier. So owners of proof, trustee have to have to evidence whatever decision they make is in the member's best financial interest. And when we want to note the word financial means there are numbers involved. Numbers involved means there are actuaries involved. There you go. So actuaries may bring a holistic perspective, both quantitatively and qualitatively. Actuaries are well placed to assist trustees make decisions in members' best financial interest and also evidence those decisions. So how do we know trustees make acting in members' best financial interest? They need to have analysis that's undertaken. And that's when actuaries come in. Actuarial advice. How do we make BFIT is best financial interest duty, BFIT decisions defensible for the trustee? So there are many things we can do within super funds. And it's unfortunate yesterday we went to Amy's and Vivian's presentation. There are not many actuaries who work in super funds, but we're hoping to see more in future. So the trustee is actually not the insurer, are responsible for the design of default settings in their super fund. But we don't see that happening a lot at the moment. Some trustees use the insurers as the this will design their default settings. The default has to be tailored to the fund members. The assessment on trade-offs need to be done and need to be sustainable, and there would need to be member equity analysis. And all of this work is a trustee actuarial work. Tenders, renewals, and re-rate advice. The actuaries play a big role in this space. When there is re-rate and tenders, it is important to have actuarial input to make sure there is an independent view of the pricing and terms to demonstrate that insurer selection and the pricing decisions are optimal for members. Claims experience. How can the actuaries help? To design the lead indicators to detect foreseeable member detriment. For example, with a TPD case, there is a sustainable issue. If the trustee has been if the actuaries have worked with the trustee, they should be able to say there is an issue here. Therefore, the trustee can implement timely governance action. System design and changes, translate design into rules, into specs, independent testing and assurance, monitoring and assurance frameworks, quantitative monitoring, dashboards, reconciliations, and carrying out SPS 250 reviews. Member outcomes and communications. So member outcomes, measures, and cohort impacts to assess cross-subsidies, communications, making sure, and actuaries is also very important, have played an important role to make sure the communications to members are accurate and complete. So in the Q-Super class action, for example, if the actuaries have come in to review those communications with the opting, we may have a different outcome. Remediation, actuaries can play a big role in the remediation calculations, methodologies. Management of reserves. Every super fund have reserve, member reserve, admin reserve, insurance reserve, ORFR. Actuaries can play a role in making sure the reserves are adequate, can do a projection, is fair, distributed fairly, and there is a purpose, and there is a proper disclosure of those reserves. Appointed actuary. Now, an independent expert reporting to the board. We don't have an appointed actuary requirement at the moment in the super fund, which is to me, I think it's very unfortunate. We have a big role to play, especially under the owners of proof legislation today. Having an appointed actuary can really support the trustee make strong decisions and an independent decision. And having this independent expert reporting directly to the board, we could be another new line of defense for the trustee, and not just being a generalist, but being the expert in our field. Closing, back to where it all started, the Royal Commission. We're going to revisit some of these questions. The Royal Commission, what has it ever done for us? Is it a gift to the industry? Well, I think so. You may or may not. Who thinks the Royal Commission made a difference? If you can show your hands again after going through all of these slides. Made a difference? Okay, almost everyone. Who thinks the Royal Commission still make a difference now? Oh, almost everyone this time, which is good. Fantastic, we changed your mind. Now, we're going to play a little clip, hopefully just finish up
with a little... Hey, let us, white bastards. They've taken everything we had, and not just from us. From our fathers and from our fathers' fathers.
And from our fathers' fathers' fathers.
Yeah.
And from our fathers' 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 fathers.
You understand? Don't labour the point. And what have they ever given us?
Aqueduct.
What?
Yeah, aqueduct.
Oh, yeah, they did give us that. That's true, yeah.
And the sanitation.
Oh, yeah, the sanitation, Reg. Remember what the city used to be like?
Yeah, all right, I'll grant you, the aqueduct and sanitation are two things the Romans had done.
And the roads.
Well, yeah, obviously the roads. I mean, the roads go without saying, don't they? But apart from the sanitation, the aqueduct and the roads...
Irrigation, medicine,
education. Yeah, all right, fair enough.
And the wine.
Yeah, that's something we've really missed, Reg, if the Romans left.
Public baths.
And it's safe to walk in the streets at night now, Reg.
Yeah, they certainly know how to keep order. Let's face it, the only ones who could in a place like this.
All right, but apart from the sanitation, the medicine, education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, a fresh water system and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us?
There's more, but I'm going to stop here. So what has the Romans ever done for us? Therefore, what... has the Royal Commission ever done for us? Thoughts? SPS 250? All right. SPS 250. Stapling? Fantastic. Stapling. Okay. Stapling. All right. Very regulating. Okay. Any further thoughts?
Fees for
no service? For fees for service, yes, perfect. No. Just come out as a mouthful. Any further thoughts?
Far reporting.
Fantastic, that's right. Members with financial interest, member outcomes. Okay.
Supervisor of the supervisors.
Yes, that's right. All right, that's it. Okay. What has the Royal Commission ever done for us? Members of Best Financial Interest Covenant, the honours approved, FAR, stapling, improved SPS 250, improved guidance from the directors and regulators, class actions, regulatory enforcements, and supervisor of the regulators, FRAA, and also a regular review of the regulators' performance. Thank you very much.
That was fascinating, and thank you for giving us such an amazing catalogue of seeing what other funds or mistakes have been detected. So I'm not suggesting that only those funds made those mistakes. They just happened to be unlucky in coming to the regulator attention or class actions. We know we're running close to time and we know it's lunchtime, but we do have a few questions from the audience, and we hope that we might have a that are written. And if there's any questions from here, you know, we'd love to hear from them. One of the questions is, couldn't a class action lead to full remediation if so ruled by the court?
That's a good question. If it went to the court, yes, it's possible. But typically they'll settle before that because the parties, particularly the funder, they're listed on the stock exchange, the funders. They have a risk profile and they don't want to end up with zero. Right? So they will put pressure on the settlement. And then of course there's also some financial interest in the plaintiff's lawyers. They're picking up some of that bill. So typically there'll be a settlement. It's pretty rare that it'll go to court. We saw one that went to court. And the lawyers, the funders went down. So it's quite a risk for them, and they will have spent millions of dollars on that.
It could be said it's a little bit overwhelming to hear about all of this, and particularly the onus of proof to show that you did think about something rather than that you did something wrong, to prove that you considered each issue and documented it. Given that lots of trustees don't like spending money, and they're trying to keep, their staffing low and insurance, isn't a high priority, what's a quick win or, what could trustees do in the short run just to try and tighten up things and reduce their exposure to these actions.
I'll go for that one. This is just my personal opinion. I think it will be highly beneficial for Superfund trustee to invest in a strong actuarial function, if possible, an appointed actuary. Because as you can see, the actuaries can have such a holistic view of everything. So when we talk about insurance within super, often we have observed that trustees sell it as something that has to be marketable. But the trustee's job is to look after members' best financial interest. That is the fundamental goal. It's not about how marketable it is. So we need actuaries to come in to do that level of analysis for the trustees and give advice to the trustee, which is kind of lacking in the industry today. A lot of the time, the products are designed by people from marketing, making sure it is marketable. So I would say if there is investment required, it doesn't cost that much to have a few actuaries in a super fund, is to invest in actuaries.
Thank you. I think drawing on from a previous session where we had Jane McGill from, I always get the acronyms wrong, APRA, and Jared Kerr, it seems very clear that we need some more courage and we need some better governance about insurance. And I think actuaries are very well placed to contribute there, so not just the technical pricing and product features. We just had a comment, could we look to AFCA for determinations for lessons?
Oh, well, absolutely we could. One of the things why we wouldn't is because they don't set law, so the case law isn't determined by AFCA decisions. But they are of interest because you can see what someone who's independent, if you like, thought about the two sides, and they're certainly a lot cheaper. And we haven't done that. We haven't gone through AFCA decisions there. But it would be an interesting overlay to see if there are any learnings there.
In preparing for this, I thought, well, when I heard you talking about just because everybody else does it or it's standard or we've already done it, always done it this way, I started to think about limited cover and, you know, how we give people limited cover but we charge them the same premium and often they go to claim and they don't get anything. And we can say, well, everyone does it. You know, it's a way to, protect against anti-selection. But if we haven't considered or costed it, if there was a class action saying this is not fair, you've ripped people off, what do you think? Is that something that's a risk?
Absolutely. That's a latent risk. That's if you haven't considered that issue at all, very much a risk. If you have considered it and tried to do something, you're in a lot better position. And that would be also reviewing the terms of, well, why did someone end up with limited cover? Was it to make life easy, or is there some correlation between what they've lost and their additional risk? And if you don't know the answer to that as a trustee, you're going to be in all sorts of trouble if ASIC comes up.
And finally, I was just curious, what motivated you to spend so much of your personal life to catalogue all of these class actions? You know, because at the back of their paper, there's just pages and pages so you can find everything. It's like an encyclopedia. What motivated you to do that?
I'll go first. Thank you. I am really, really passionate about the super industry, especially insurance within super. When I look at do some research, premiums, we paid about $6 billion of premiums every year, what members do. And then about $5.4 billion went back to members through claims. It's a huge industry, and working in the super funds in the past years, I have noticed that the trustees don't put enough focus on insurance within super. There is lots of investment there is lots of investments of expenses in investments, but there is very little within insurance. Some of these are discussed in the latent risks around priority and board competency. So it is my passion, I feel that this area is not well understood because of the lack of actuaries within super funds. So it is my passion to address that, hoping that one day the trustees will not treat insurance within super as an afterthought, but something they can use as a competitive advantage.
Yeah, and we have no, at the moment, we have no right to just get the work to give it given to us, like we appointed actuary, particularly appointed actuary.
we've actually got to break down the door as actuaries. If we want this work that, Karen listed, we have to break down the door. We have to show that we're of value. And when I was a student actuary, that's what the general insurance actuaries were doing. The entrepreneurial actuaries were banging down the doors of the general insurers saying, we can add value to your business. And we have to do that as a profession. We can't expect them to come to us.
Okay, thank you very much. And I can personally attest to their generosity of spirit because they've led three ASFA discussion groups insurance that I've chaired, and they've presented many times as the public face of the first public policy statement on group insurance and super, as well as another paper last year. So we're very lucky to have you, and thank you to the wonderful audience for turning up and staying the extra 5 minutes. So please enjoy your lunch.